Now we are going to fall. We are going to strike out. But we better be there in humility, in confession, in repentance when that happens. And you know what I've seen in young people, let's go back to the ball game again. When somebody does their best and they fail, there's a lot of support for that. If we are honest and we're upfront and we say, yes, I failed. I think the young people extend us a lot of grace if we can be humble about our failures and be honest about our failures. The problem comes when we pretend that we're not human anymore. We pretend that we don't fail. When we project this perfect image, and they know and we know that it's not real. That's a problem. Let's be honest with each other. And it's such a temptation to not span that gap, that generation gap. Quite frankly, sometimes we're scared of each other. The older people are scared of the young people, and the younger are scared or suspicious of the older ones. And that's a tragedy when that happens. And it's something that I think as Christians, it should not happen. And we should be actively working to build relationships with each other. There's negative peer pressure. And that's a big one. And other people are doing it. Why can't I do it? We're trying to figure those things out. There's maybe aggressive youth politics. We'll talk about that a little more later. And then there's fear. Something about being a young person is, do you remember that, you older ones back there? That angst, that nervousness, that stone in your stomach, that you're going to do something wrong? Here a while back, we were having Bible school over here at the gym, and I was in the fortunate position of not being in Bible school on the first day. And this was on Saturday, I think. And I walked into the gym, and here's a row of boys over here, and here's a row of girls over here. And nobody's talking, and everybody's standing there just as nervous as can be. And they're sort of glancing at each other, but nobody wants to talk, nobody wants to make the first move. And I told them very cheerfully, I said, I know exactly how you feel, and I'm so glad I'm not there anymore. You know, fear of each other, actually, can be a big thing. But there's fear of the unknown. There's fear maybe of being pushed into adulthood. Things are happening too fast. And there's the fear that we're going to fail. There's, quite frankly, sometimes there's the fear of God, and not in a good way. We're afraid of God. We're afraid of damnation. We're afraid of vulnerability. We're afraid of inadequacy. We're afraid of rejection. We're afraid of rejection by God. We're afraid of rejection by our peers or by life. We're going to be a failure. We have fear of lack of control. I don't know about the rest of you, but those are all things that I experienced. And those things I know are real. And so just some things that helped me that I'd like to share. And one of these is this verse in 1 John that we read about in verse 18. And one thing I think we need to get is the context here of this verse, because I'll go more into that later, but verse 18, there's no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear, because fear has torment. He that fears is not made perfect in love. And you know, if you have a fearful person that reads that verse, it actually can just make it worse if you don't have the context for it. Because, you know, you read this and it says, he that fears is not made perfect in love. Oh, here's just another mark against me, because I fear and therefore I'm not made perfect and therefore I'm even worse off than I was before. That's not the way it's given. It's given as an invitation. It's given in gentleness, that God is love and he doesn't want you to live in fear. And you don't need to live in fear. And if some of this is inevitable, some of the angst, I've never met a young person yet who just felt perfectly confident all the time. And quite frankly, those of you who are suspicious that everybody else has it together and you don't, I think it's almost a rule of thumb that those who appear the most cool, their emotions are always in check. They have it together all the time. That's, as a rule of thumb, those people, that's a facade. That's a facade for a scared person, a person who is too scared to let down their guard and let anybody in. And when it comes to fear, here's a fact. Emotion trumps logic. So when our emotions are running high, logic has a hard time making it in. If you're scared, even the truth sometimes doesn't make sense. And that's why it's so important that our emotions are in check when we face important decisions. And God gave you a mind for a reason. You're allowed to think. You're supposed to think. But it can be extremely difficult to bring logic into a fraught emotional situation. The answers that logic and truth hold can sometimes just feel wrong or inaccessible. And, you know, if you've ever struggled with depression, you know what I'm talking about. It doesn't really help. It doesn't seem to help to know the fact that God loves you. It just seems so far away. But it's important that if you are facing fear or depression or anxiety, that you seek the truth in your situation, because God brings you answers of truth. He doesn't let you just hang out there in fear. One of the most important steps forward in this kind of a situation is to find someone whom you trust and who is qualified to help you in these situations. And just as a side note to parents, our children are people. And, you know, I'm speaking as a father of non-teenagers, preteens. And so, you know, who am I to say these things? But these are ideals that I have in my mind. And here again, I think ideals are important. And sometimes we fail to live up to our ideals. And that should not keep us from making them. Our children are people, not just extensions of ourselves. They're not automatons. Let's cultivate trust, and let's be trustworthy. Back to this thing of parents, authority figures, who are willing to be honest and willing to be repentant. So talking about our situation, talking about your situation, if you feel this fear, if you feel panic, talking about your situation with somebody who has been in your situation before can help put things into perspective. And, you know, these things that maybe seem so accessible, when you can talk about them, they maybe they shrink a little bit. So if that is your case, if you do have that kind of if you're experiencing that in your life and it's becoming a problem, find somebody you can talk to. It's important, and it's one of the greatest ways that God has given us to minister to each other. And unfortunately, for some, sensing fear or weakness in someone is an invitation to strike. And I don't know why that happens so much in young people, but it does. Unfortunately, it's probably going to happen to you at some point. When you're feeling vulnerable or when you're feeling weak or in fear, then it seems like some people take that as an opportunity to kick. And just keep this in mind if you are experiencing that, both ways. If you feel like you have somebody that's in range of your foot, or if you feel like somebody has been knocking you when you're down. This is essentially the definition of a coward and a bully, and is also a sign of one's own sense of fear and inadequacy. But for some, sensing fear or weakness in someone is an invitation to care, and this is a sign of a child of God. And for you, if you are experiencing these things, and it seems like it doesn't make any sense, and it says here, fear has torment. You feel a bit tormented. Just remember this. God can use that fear. God can use that pain. Because there are others around you who are also feeling it. And one of the gifts that God has given us as humans is empathy, to feel with those and for those around us. For some, the knowledge of their own pain, their own fear, their own weakness precludes their ability to see any other pain or fear around them. It's just like the whole world is my pain and my fear, and I can't see out of it. And that's a loop that can feed itself, and it can turn into a habit that will just simply go on throughout your whole life. And that's really important that you don't allow that kind of thinking to take root in your life. And we can become consumed by negativity. But for some, the knowledge over their own pain, their own fear, their own weakness, these things are doorways to recognizing our need for Christ. Sorry. Verse 9, and this was manifested, the love of God toward us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through him. And so, you know, in a way, weakness and pain and fear is a blessing, because it drives us to God, and it drives us to recognize that we cannot, in our own strength, accomplish anything. And if fear drives us toward God is a blessing. But fear has torment. And until we reach that place, I'm convinced, until we reach that place of turning that over to Christ, it simply consumes us. And yet, when Christ is our healing, when Christ is our strength, then we actually, this experience opens our eyes to empathy in those around us. And as Christ works in our lives, and as we win some of these victories, and that aloneness, and that sense of inadequacy, and that sense of impending doom is replaced. By a sense of belonging. By the knowledge that God loves me, not because I'm such a good person, not because I'm such a catch, that he really got something good when he got me, but because he loves me, that he came and died for me. Then I view the actions of those around me a little bit differently. You know, because if you've, it said, I think it was Emerson, not positive on that, but one of our American poets said that those who have experienced no pain seldom believe that it is felt. And you know, it's actually a curse if you experience life without pain, because it cuts you off from the ability to help those around you. But when you have experienced pain yourself and you know what it feels like, it opens your eyes a little bit to those around us. And when you see somebody who is afraid to let down the doors, then rather than being judgmental and rather than, you know, saying, well, what a snip there, your heart goes out to them. And that's a real blessing that God can give you. The very things that cause you such internal suffering are the paths God uses to open our eyes and to give us empathy and recognition of those traits and those around us. And the fact is, and it's just going to be that way, that some people leave a wide swath of damage in their wake, and they don't realize that they are part of the cause for the imperfections they see in those around us. And you're going to run into those people, people who have their arms wide and they're swinging their fists. And then when they cause pain and when people start acting in imperfect ways, then they just stand there and blame them. It's the way some people live. It's one of those situations where, as an adult, you have to come to this stance. So you say, you know what, it's not fair and it's not right. That's the way some people are. And, you know, it's difficult for us as young people sometimes to come to grips with that. But let it be a lesson for yourself when you experience that. Be careful with your words and your actions. They have consequences. They have effects in those around us. And there are certain things that we... You know, I do believe that it's good to teach in positive ways. You know, we should use good, positive language, upbuilding rather than simply calling out negativity. And yet there are certain things that we never learn, truly learn, until we have experienced some hard things. And, you know, you never, if you only have teachers in your growing up years who were perfect in the way they treat their students, you might not understand how it feels if you have a teacher who is unfair and who is is uncaring. That's a lesson that you learn by experiencing an unfair and an uncaring teacher, and that's how that feels. And then you recognize that's a chance for you to say, you know, I'll never treat a child like that. So that's some of the things that can happen. Trying to insulate yourself from all hurt will also result in sealing yourself off from much joy. And this temptation's no fun. And you know, when I have to think of the father who had come to Jesus' disciples for healing of his son, who was possessed by a devil. You remember that boy? And they weren't able to cast it out. They weren't able to take care of the problem. And the father came, or Jesus came up about that time. And the father came running over to Jesus and said, can you please heal my son? Your disciples tried and they couldn't. And Jesus said, I will if you can believe. And the father said, I will, I believe. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. And, you know, he had trouble believing. And sometimes in our fear and in our temptation, we have trouble with that, with logic. We have trouble with hanging on to truth. It's no fun. But remember the answer that Jesus gave to this man as he healed his son. If you are in a difficult place and all you can do is cry out, Lord, help my unbelief, God hears that. So take courage. When the battle begins inside a man, then he is worth something. The human condition includes pain. That's true both of believers and unbelievers. And this is one of the results of the fall. There is nothing innately redeeming about pain. I don't believe that God, as a general rule, hands out pain as arbitrary testing or shaping tools. Sometimes we get the idea that God hands out this pain to see what we'll do with it. I don't believe that God does that. I think it's a result, many times at least, that it's a result of the fall. I'm not saying that sometimes God doesn't reach into a situation and do that, because I do believe that he can use pain both to chastise us and to draw us. But watching an innocent child suffering with leukemia or seeing a saint of God slowly succumbing to Alzheimer's is to observe that the fall of man brought pain into the world as our inheritance. The difference between the child of the world and the child of God in regards to the pain that we experience is that God can redeem your pain. He can redeem our pain and change it into a force for our good and for the good of those around us. For those who are without God, the pain of the human condition has nothing redemptive about it. It simply leads to despair. But we know differently, don't we? We've seen it happen. We've seen people transformed by their pain. We've seen how it has purged away carnality and has been a harbinger of transformation. We've seen God work miracles of grace through the vehicle of difficulties and tragedies. But it's only been as people surrender themselves to God and his work in their lives that this happens. All right, we're already 11:30 here. The next thing I'd like to talk about is group relationships. And specifically about this thing of cliques. I'll just put the word out there. And what are cliques? And how do they affect us? What results do they have? Is it just a teenage phenomenon? Or do they have repercussions later on in life. You know, I think it's true that when there is a larger group of people, let's just use this group for example, because I think as a church, we are called out from the world. It's not a clique when we're called out from the world, when we disassociate ourselves from evil doing among evil doers. But when you've got a group of people who have been called out by God and who are claiming to be God's people, and yet inside that, something happens where there are political groups, whether that's in young people or in older ones, where you've got these little cells with walls all around them and spikes at the top, and nobody can come in unless they're invited. That's a clique. And I think it's driven by a combination of fear and of pride. It's the way it usually happens. And often it's a sign of our own insecurities when we feel like we need to resort to drawing back and forming this group of us versus them. One of the most important skills you'll ever learn is how to work with people who are unlike you. If you fail to learn this skill, you'll live in isolation all your life. Now, this is one of the downfalls of relying on a small cadre in the context of your youth group and in your church family to give you a sense of security and safety. And just a comment to the older ones as well. We can do the same thing toward our youth group. I think in a healthy church environment, we should be back and forth. And, you know, we talk about cliques in the youth group. What about us and the way we treat them? Let's work on bridging those gaps in generations, between generations. And the unfortunate thing is that cool young people, and now I'm using cool as in the in ones, or the ones who during their young years seem to have it all together. We talk about in the world, they talk about the phenomenon of the star high school athletes that grow up, and that's all they ever were, and that's all they can ever talk about, and that's where their sort of their high point was, their teenage years when they happened to be the quarterback on the local high school team, and it never grows past that. These kinds of people have a distressingly high rate of failure as adults, and it's often the ones who struggled along in their teen years who are actually successful in building their characters and coming into their strength in adulthood. And there's a lot of different ways that this affects us. But going back here to 1 John again, do we need to say anything after we read 1 John? Just ask this question. Jesus' view of social outcasts or sidelined individuals, does it match our own? And, you know, I think one of the things that is often stated, and it's a hurtful thing, is, well, why? I don't even care about this. It's not like I am against them or mad at them or anything. I just don't think of them. And that's viewed as a thing that's a positive thing. And it's a bad thing to think. It's a bad way to think and a bad way to live, is uncaring, unknowledgeable of the way we affect others. Remember what I was saying about the people who walk through life with their arms wide and their fists swinging? That's a sign of that kind of a person, when the effect that we have on each other is that unconscious. And if these bring up a defensiveness in you, maybe a little bit of an anger, I just invite you to examine that a bit, because it may be a sign that this is actually true. This fear and pride are at the root of these types of things. And I'm not trying to be blaming or to be derisive. But I would just invite you to look at that, because pride and fear are a lethal combination when it comes to sacrificial brotherhood, whether it's in the youth group or whether it's later on in life. Humility and caring and the mind of Christ are at the core of the ideal brotherhood experience. I'm going to say ideal brotherhood experience because it doesn't always work that way, does it? It's what we try for, to have humility, to have the mind of Christ, and have caring. Doesn't always happen. That's what we should always be striving for. Different relationships are important, and it's fine to have best friends. And it's true, it's natural, that you're simply going to get along better with a few people in your circle of acquaintances. And that's okay. I'm not saying that's a problem. That's okay. Some of you just enjoy talking about hunting all the time, and the rest of you want to talk about books. You know how it is. It's just there's certain people, they get you and you get them, and you can have a lot more of an enjoyable experience talking to those people. And that's, I'm not saying that's a problem. But what is a problem is when we sort of we create boundaries and we don't let other people into our lives. And maybe we mock other people, or sometimes there's this thing of an anti-clique or an anti-club where we simply, because they think they're cooler than us, well, we'll be cooler than them. And if we can't be part of their group, then we'll make our own and they can't be in that one. It all turns bad and pretty sour pretty quickly. And once again, is this the mind of Christ? As children of God, our first response to those around us should be a response of caring. And ask yourself this, what's the result or the product of those close relationships that I have? Do they result in aloofness, in fear of others, a sense that you're better than them because of your privileged status in the best group? There are different levels of relationships, and you can't be all things to all people. But you can be an encouragement to everybody. You don't have to be best friends with everybody, but you can be an encouragement to everybody around you. And here again, I'm trying to speak honestly here, and this is maybe an uncomfortable one. But as church family, I think we need to be careful with the ethos of family first. Family is the most important thing that you ever experience. And family is a wonderful, wonderful experience. If it's done, if God is in that family and there's a closeness and maybe you have a broad circle of cousins and so on, and it's just a real blessing. But use that blessing for the glory of God. Don't use it to step away from your church family. Use that as a mission opportunity, as a force for good. Reach out to those around us. If you've got that kind of a situation, then let God enter that equation. And maybe if you feel like you have been rejected, the temptation can be to be bitter or to be angry at those around you. And there again, that's the mind of Christ isn't in that. Can't be everything to everybody, but you can be an encouragement to everybody. Okay, I'm going to bring this to a close. But I'd like to read just a little bit in Daniel, in the first book of Daniel, the first chapter of Daniel. This is a scripture that we often use when we are talking about young people. But I think it does have something that is just really powerful. And, we talked about imperfect situations versus perfect ones. And maybe you look around you and you say, if I could only be in that family, then that he has it so much easier than I do. Or if I could only be as pretty as she was, then as she is, then I could, I wouldn't have to feel like this or whatever it is. But here we've got Daniel in about the worst kind of situation that you can possibly imagine. He's captured, he's taken away from his parents. More than likely they were killed. Everything that he knew and could tie himself to was gone, except for his relationship with God. And in that situation, in that difficult time, you find verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Daniel purposed in his heart. And you've got a lot of ways to go wrong, and you've got only a few ways to go right. Choose wisely. purpose with Daniel in your heart, not to defy yourself with the world and to follow God. Let me ask you a question. We've got, as Americans, we tend to buy into the culture around us in unconscious ways. And one of the ways we buy in is the way we view our teenage years. And, you know, is it just a time of hanging out and waiting for something to happen, waiting for bigger things and better things? Here's the question. When are you going to start living? Look around you. Whom do you see? Who has God put into your life? What do you see? What opportunities has God given you? As a child of God, you have been called to minister. Don't focus on yourself. Focus on Him. Walk with Him. Give yourself wholly to Him. It's the only way to truly live. Should we kneel for prayer?